Right, before I say my blessing this morning, I want to discuss a little Hebrew. And that's him in the middle there in the white shirt. But you've heard me say this blessing I don't know how many hundreds of times, right? And reading from right to left in the top line, Hebrews right to left, by now pretty much everyone recognizes that that word is the covenant name of God. YHVH, YHWH, however you want to spell it. And I never say that word in keeping with tradition. Instead, I substitute the word Adonai. And I've said all these years, for I don't know how many years, that that's kind of my Lord. But I didn't know quite why, how I could make it work with the Hebrew. And it first appears in Judges 13:8 when Manoah is the first one to address directly my Lord. Well, guess what? I learned through the week it's actually the emphatic form of my Lord, and that's why I didn't understand it. So it's actually my Lord with several exclamation marks after it. Learn something every day. And I thought I'd share that with you because I know that's just going to keep you awake tonight thinking about that. It's such it's a riveting thing, isn't it? Anyway, moving on. Today, oh, I didn't say it, did I? Too late. I know it by heart. Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam asher kiddashanu baruch acha v'tzivanu lasot b'devrecha. Amen. Today is our light series, Loose Ends, which for our visitors is when folks here give me a passage and I go away for a week or so and try and make sense of it. And today's passage comes from Judges 19, chapter 19, verses 22 to 30. It's the story of the Levite's concubine. Now, I'm estimating this teaching this morning will be PG-13. So some viewer discretion is advised. If you have school-aged kids under 13, you may want to think about whether you keep them in or not. It will take me some minutes for some background and some Bible texts. So if you don't want the kids inside, now's your opportunity to take them somewhere else, okay? The book of Judges covers Israel's history from about 1380 to 1050 BC. It was written by the prophet Samuel, that's his old ID card there. He lived from around 1070 to 1012. And the book of Judges records the tragic story of Israel's cyclical failure. So if you start at the 12 o'clock position in the diagram, Israel would serve the Lord and then they'd commit idolatry. And then they'd be enslaved. God would allow them to be overtaken by a foreign power. And then they'd cry out to God. And then God would raise up a judge for them and he'd deliver them from their enemies. And then they'd serve the Lord and then after a little while it'd start all over again. And a judge, of course, in this historical context means a ruler. And the reason for this sad cycle is given four times in the book of Judges. Here's the first one, Judges chapter 17, verse 6. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And twice Samuel elaborates on why this causes a problem. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And that's pretty much like our world today, isn't it? Morality is pretty flexible today. Well, that's your truth. My truth is different to your truth. Well, today's story begins in chapter 19, which starts the same way in verse 1. And it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel that there was a certain Levite. Now, by the time of Judges, even the priesthood, the Levites, had become corrupt. In chapters 17 and 18, we read about a Levite who became a priest for hire. He became a private idolatrous priest. And in those days, that was based on the belief that there was no DIY faith. You had to have a priest to go through. Similar thing happened in Elizabethan England when Catholicism was bad. Well-heeled Catholics had their own personal priests and they would perform the Mass and his confession and so forth. And if a nosy Protestant showed up, they had a priest hole hidden in the house somewhere where Father so-and-so could go and hide and no one would knew there was a priest in residence. This is Israel around 1100 BC, and there are the 12 tribal allocations to the various tribes, obviously. For comparison, the modern state of Israel on the same scale approximately. The one on the right doesn't have too many cities in it, but of the ones that are there, there's at least four that still existed in the time of the judges and are there today. We've got Beersheba, Gaza, Ashdod, and of course Jerusalem are still on this map here. Our story is centered in this region, in Ephraim, and also in a bit of Benjamin, and that is, of course, Palestinian territory today. Now, what this Levite did was questionable, though not technically sinful. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. So he had Ephraim, Benjamin, Judah. So he went down to the south to fetch himself a concubine. Wasn't technically against the law. But a Levite's conduct was meant to be beyond reproach. They were the sort of representatives of God on earth. Concubines were not exactly slaves. They were more than a slave. They were less than a wife, but they were considered family. They had fewer social privileges and were guaranteed no inheritance. Firstborn son was responsible for taking care of mum when dad died. Concubine got nothing, not even her own children. But some owners would leave a legacy for their concubine, but they were not guaranteed a sausage. There's no mention of our Levite actually having a wife. So one wonders if he had one, maybe he couldn't get anyone to marry him, I don't know. But did this work out, him taking a concubine from Bethlehem? Verse 2 and 3. But his concubine played the harlot against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem, in Judah, down south, and was there for whole months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. So why did he wait 4 months before he pursued her? Well, I think it was because she played the harlot, and we didn't have any of these in those days. So I think it was probably to make sure that she wasn't carrying another man's child. And just a small point while we're here, the word husband is culturally true for a concubine, but it's not the Hebrew word for husband. It is the word ish, which simply is the word for man. The word for husband is Baal, which was the name of the Canaanite fertility god, wasn't it? Baal, that you read about in the Old Testament. Well, he was persuaded by the girl's father to remain in Bethlehem for a while. Verse 4, now his father-in-law, inverted commas, the young woman's father, detained him and he stayed with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. They left for the mountains of Judah late on day 4, actually. So now I'm going to blow up the area we want to look at. They started off in Bethlehem in Judah to the south. And Bethlehem, of course, in Hebrew, Beit Lechem, house of bread. And how appropriate is that? Because that's where our master was born, and he was the bread of life, wasn't he? He was the bread from heaven. He was the bread from the earth when he rose in resurrection from the grave. They went past, in Arabic, Beit Lechem, almost the same. When I first went to live in Saudi, I started learning Arabic. I lost interest in it, but I got into an argument with the teacher. He's saying, and of course, Beit Lechem means house of meat. No, it doesn't. Yes, it does. No, it doesn't. Yes, it does. Well, in Arabic, it does, predictably, but it really should be house of bread because that's where our Lord came from. Anyway, they went past Jerusalem. It's called Jebus in the book of Judges, which is an old name for it. And they ended up in a place called Gibeah, which is about here in the territory of Benjamin. They chose to spend the night in Gibeah, still in Benjamin. Get down to verse 15 now. At sundown, they turned aside there to go into lodge in Gibeah. Well, what do we know about this city of Gibeah? Here's three roads for you. Or as the Romans would have said, here's trivia. That's a little Latin joke there. You get it? Don't give up my day job, right? Yeah, okay. All right. Now, it was during Samuel's ministry that Israel demanded their own king. 1 Samuel 8, 4 and 5. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations, judge meaning rule, right? Word nations is the Hebrew word goyim, which nearly always means the Gentile nations, the heathens, the pagans. How's that going to work out? We want to be just like the pagan nations and have a king. We don't want God to rule over us. Is that going to work well? So Saul, as you know, was the first king of Israel, and he was born in Gibeah around 1080 BC. He was a Benjamite. No, not a Vegemite. Get away. A Benjamite. Sorry about that. Whereas the godly line would come from Judah, wouldn't it? So Saul would never work out as king. It was bound to fail. But God gave the people what they wanted, knowing, of course, it was all part of his purposes in the end. Where are we? And when he went in, this is back in Gibeah again, he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. They were finally given hospitality, not from the Vegemites. Verse 16, just then an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who was also from the mountains of Ephraim. He was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites. We'll skip down now to verse 20. And the old man said, peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square. So he brought him into his house and gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. Now we're finally up to our loose end passage, and what a sordid and disgusting tale it is. Beginning in verse 22 and going through to verse 30. As they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came to your house, that we may know him carnally. No, not Connolly. Who does these things? Carnally. You call that gross? Oh, that's not gross. I'll show you gross. It gets even grosser. The host tries to prevent it, verse 23. But the man, the master of the house, went into them and said, no, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage. His alternative is horribly wicked. Look, here is my virgin daughter and this man's concubine. Let me bring them out now, humble them, and do with them as you please. Imagine being one of those ladies. Like, seriously? Imagine being the man's daughter. Dad! Isn't it awful? And this phrase, by the way, is the whole story of Judges, where it says, as you please. It's tov benechem, which means good in your own eyes. The whole story of Judges. Do what's good in your own eyes with them. But to this man, do not do such a vile thing. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're saying, hang on a moment. As Yogi Berra once said, it's deja vu all over again, isn't it? And as deja vu himself once said, haven't we met before, monsieur? See, this is a similar incident to what happened in Sodom in Genesis 19, wasn't it? Do you remember that? Now, there are similarities and there are differences between the two events, but this loose end will cover both of them. First, the similarities. Two angels planned to stay overnight in the city square. Genesis 19, starting in verse 3. But Lot insisted strongly, so they turned into him and entered his house. And the men of Sodom lived up to their name and reputation. The men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally. Lot also tried to prevent their wicked behaviour. Verses 6 and 7. So Lot went out to them through the doorway, shut the door behind them and said, please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly, offering them an alternative that is, again, just appalling to us. Verse 8. See, now I have two daughters who have not known a man. Please let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them as you wish. Do what is right in your own eyes. Only do nothing to these men, since this is the reason they have come under the shadow of my roof. Differences, of course, are in Lot's day, the angel struck the wicked men with blindness. And Lot and his family for the most part, escaped, and the city was destroyed. Lot's wife was a bit of a pillar of the community, salt of the earth, you know. But in the Gibeah incident, verse 25, back to Judges, but the men would not heed him. There's no blinding of the wicked. So the man took his concubine and brought her out to them. Well, surely the husband defended his concubine's honour. No, in point of fact, he didn't. He was a bit like Sir Robin, the not-so-brave, and he remembered an important Zoom meeting at that very moment. And they knew her and abused her all night until morning. I can't begin to imagine the horror that this woman experienced. And there have been countless others throughout human history, haven't there? But how unbelievably awful. And after they'd destroyed her life, when the day began to break, they let her go, which was awfully nice of them, wasn't it? Verse 26, then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light. So by the way, this word master is the word Adon, Lord, master. And that's where Adonai comes from, my Lord, in its emphatic tense. Well, now it's time for our hero to make a dramatic entrance. When her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go to his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house. And the last bit of this verse just really gets to me. Maybe it does you too, with her hands on the threshold. You just picture that, you know? Had she been reaching for the door? Or had she been knocking and banging on the door and they'd been sort of not listening, cowards that they were, while she desperately sought help? Just breaks my heart, that bit. Well, our hero was fully sympathetic toward his fallen concubine. Verse 28, he said to her, get up, let's be going. But there was no answer. Now, I always assumed this was because she was dead, and it kind of hints at that in the next chapter, but so does the Septuagint. Septuagint translation says, he said to her, arise and let us depart, but she did not answer because she was dead. That's the Greek translation from 250 BC. So there was no answer. Still, he wasn't grief-stricken enough to delay his journey, so the man lifted her onto the donkey. The man got up and went to his place. At least he didn't leave her for scavengers like Jezebel, you know. And back in Ephraim, he doubtless buried her with dignity, or not. Verse 29, when he entered his house, he took a knife, laid hold of his concubine, divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. I mean, as you would. That's what you do, isn't it? Why 12 pieces? One for each of the 12 tribes, to make a statement. How did the good folk of Israel react to their unusual gift through the post? Verse 30, our last verse. And so it was that all who saw it said, no such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up. And here ends the reading of our passage in all its repugnance. No, not Rapunzel, repugnance. So what happened then? What was the next thing? Well, Judges 20 describes the subsequent civil war between 11 tribes of Israel and the tribe of Benjamin. They were horrified. And our passage, as they always do, raises three questions. Question one, why is this gross incident recorded in the Holy Scriptures, along with the one of Lot? Why is it there? Question number two, why did God punish the men of Sodom with blindness and not the men of Gibeah? And question number three, why did the Levite dismember and dispatch his concubine? Well, we'll start at the start. Why is this gross incident recorded in the Holy Scriptures? Well, for once, I think this is the easiest question to answer. Nevertheless, we'll consult the scholars who are divided. Some say, to show the result of doing what's right in one's own eyes. And that's clearly true. Others say to prove the Levite wasn't a worthy husband. I'm not sure how that works. You know, here's a picture of a scumbag. See, he really wasn't worthy. Then that's not really why you need it in the Scriptures. So I don't like that one. We'll get rid of that one. A third one is an extreme example of ancient cultural hospitality. I have heard this one quite a bit, and hospitality is incredibly important in that part of the world, persisting to this day. Where's Andrew? I was talking to Andrew last time I was here, and I mentioned an old mate of mine who was flying RAAF helicopters in the Sinai in Egypt in 1982. And he saw some Egyptian soldiers had captured a young woman and wanted to know her carnally. And their officer was obviously a good guy, the Egyptian officer. He raced over and took some of his lunch and said, "Quick, eat this." And the woman ate some, and he turned to the soldiers and said, "She has eaten my bread." And they had to back off because that meant that she was under her protection. That was their Middle Eastern hospitality. But I think this goes far beyond that, far beyond ancient Near East hospitality. So while this is clearly correct, I don't think it's complete. I think we can solve it pretty easily, really. What kind of person offers their own child for the wicked and the depraved, eh? Well, before we answer that question, where was the concubine from, do you remember? It means house of bread. Beit Lechem, Bethlehem. Who else was from Bethlehem? It's Midrash, isn't it? It's a prophetic picture of exactly what God did for you and me. He offered his own child, innocent child, for the wicked and the depraved. Happened in Genesis 19. Happens again. Make sure we get it. Just like Jephthah and his daughter in part one of this series. It's meant to offend us, folks, to help us fully grasp the gospel. See, we go on, especially as Protestants, about God is love, God is love. But do we really believe the enormity of God's love for us revealed in Christ Jesus? God, the Father, is depicted by the wicked, in a sense. He's not wicked, of course, but offering his child for others. If you take nothing else home today, take that home, all right? So that's question one. Question two, why did God punish the men of Sodom and not of Gibeah? Well, let's ask the scholars. Some say God did, but he used the other tribes of Israel. That's true. There was a civil war. Others say there was no law in Lot's day, but the Benjamites should have known better because the Torah had been given at that point. That's just completely wrong, folks. It's completely wrong to say there was no law before the Torah, before Mount Sinai. Of course there was. We did a series on it, what, 6.5 years ago? The Christian and the Torah. Way back before the Torah, before Mount Sinai, God made a promise to Isaac. Genesis 26, verse 4 and 5, "And I will make your descendants, Isaac, multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." And it's true, here we are. Why? Because Abraham, your dad, obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes and my laws. God's laws have always been around, and he communicated to people in different ways, but he made a covenant with Israel based on it that they had to keep at Mount Sinai in 1500 BC or thereabouts. See, how could Abraham keep the laws if there were none? But wait, there's more. Let's go back even further. Let's go back to the flood, before the flood in Noah's days. Was there no law then? I had a gentleman just 2 weeks ago telling me that. No, there was no law in those days. Genesis 7:2, "You shall take with you seven each of every clean animal, a male and his female, two each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female." How did Noah know what a clean animal was or an unclean animal? It doesn't appear until Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. The law's always been around. God made a covenant with Israel. But his standards don't change, people. So that one's wrong. But is this the complete answer? See, I don't think it is. I think, you know, the Civil War certainly did bring punishment to Benjamin, but we need to take a step back and look at the big picture again. Here's Israel's tribal map again, where there was no king. However, the monarchy. See, give us a king. We want to be like the other nations. There was no king. There was no king. So they got a king. Saul was a dud, but David and Solomon unified the nation into one thing, didn't they? One country. But not for long. only for a little while. Within two generations, the nation split into two, Judah to the south, Israel to the north. And by the 6th century BC, by the time the exiles returned, both kingdoms had been vanquished. And when they returned from Persia in Nehemiah Ezra's day, there was only Judah in the south, Galilee in the north, and Samaria in between. Samaria wasn't the Jewish people. Samaria were a mixed race of Jews and Assyrians that had been living there for, 200 years. The point is, the monarchy was not the solution to Israel's wickedness. And neither were the prophets. Only Messiah can fix Israel's problems, which persist to this day. That's the point of it. Question number three, why did the Levite dismember and dispatch his concubine? Well, there's no need for the scholars on this one. It's an easy one. It was a call to arms, wasn't it? Judges 20, beginning in verse 1. So all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, as well as from the land of Gilead, and the congregation gathered as one man before the Lord at Mizpah. And the leaders of all the people, all the tribes of Israel, presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Second part of verse 3. Then the children of Israel said, tell us, how did this wicked deed happen? And then we hear from the Levite himself. Verse 4. So the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, my concubine and I went to Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, to spend the night. Verse 6. So I took hold of my concubine, we know the story in between, cut her in pieces and sent her throughout all the territory of the inheritance of Israel, because they committed lewdness and outrage in Israel. And now the Levite challenges Israel. Look, all of you are children of Israel. Give your advice and counsel here and now. And civil war, as we know, was the result. But what's the moral of the story? See, in that battle, Israel lost over 40,000 men. And Benjamin lost 25,000 men to avenge the rape and murder of the Levite's concubine. Now, I'm not minimizing the wickedness of those men in Gibeah, but 65,000 dead in civil war is, pun intended, overkill. Especially when our Levite was a self-serving, self-righteous coward who couldn't care less about the welfare of his concubine, as demonstrated by his actions. Point is that this is what happens when in those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Pretty much like our Western culture today, isn't it? It's just like, where's it all gone? I've told you this before, but I often tell people I was born in another country when they say, which one? I say Australia. But it was a very different country. And the same today in Israel. Nothing's going to change until the rule of the righteous King Yeshua. And that won't be till Israel cries out for him. You won't see me again till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So, if you have Jewish friends or family, or even if you don't, pray for the peace of Jerusalem, because things aren't going to get better there, and they're not going to get better here either, until the King comes. That's all, folks. Now, I won't be here next Sunday. I'm at Sheffield. The following Sunday, we'll go back to our heavy series, the Book of Revelation, verse by verse. It'll be part 62. We'll look at Revelation 21, 7 to 27. In the meantime, if you have a loose end, if you have a verse that you can't make sense of, let me know, and I'll see. Maybe I can't make sense of it either, but I'll give it a go.